B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy whose divot you just landed in, Charlie Nance.
Welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. This is the final week for live, meaningful, professional golf until after Thanksgiving, with the PGA Tour in Sea Island, Georgia, and the European Tour having their tour championship, if you will, in Dubai. Speaking of the PGA Tour, respect and admiration must be paid to one Brendan Todd. Less than a year ago, he didn't know what planet his ball was going to land on when he hit it, much less what fairway or green. Now he's won in back-to-back weeks on tour in Bermuda and in Mexico. Maybe that's the secret. Only play tour events that are outside the continental United States. Gosh, golf's a crazy game. This week on the show, we relive a couple of recent conversations I enjoyed very much. First, Tom Pashley, president of Pinehurst, but he's much more than the president. I consider him the shepherd of all that we love and find important at the cradle of American golf. And as you think of gifts for the golfer on your list this holiday season, I cannot recommend highly enough the book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year Golf Changed Forever. And its author, Kevin Robbins, was with us recently. But we begin in the Sandhills, in my happy place, Pinehurst, with President Tom Pashley.
Tom, let me begin with a story that took place, I guess, almost 2 years ago. It was around Christmas time of 2017. My nephew had graduated from Baylor University, and he's a golf fanatic. And I told him, look, you get to the point where you're out of my sister's house, you have a job, you're paying your own rent, and you can afford a plane ticket. As a graduation gift, a weekend at Pinehurst is on me. And he called me in November, and he said, okay, I'm in. I said, you do know it's cold around this time, right? He says, I don't care. Book it. I'm coming to Pinehurst. I said, okay. So this is around the second week in December, maybe the week right before Christmas. And it was sort of an Indian summer weekend. We actually played number two in shorts, I think, on December 18th or 19th. It was fantastic. But anyway, we played number eight. We played, I think, number one, and then we played number two. And right before we left, we had lunch at the Deuce, and then we played on the Cradle. And my son actually had a hole-in-one on the Cradle. And it was a perfect day. And you had that beautiful sort of winter sunset. And as the sun was setting, we're walking towards the car in the parking lot. And I had met you before, so I recognized you from a distance. And right as I was about to say something, you stopped the three of us and you said, well, boys, how was it? And, of course, they piped up and said it was fantastic. And my son said, you know, I had a hole-in-one. And you immediately said, well, did you get your poker chip? Because if you get a hole-in-one on the Cradle, there's a poker chip with the appropriate hole that you receive as sort of a prize. And he said, yeah. And, you know, I was so taken aback. We were the only people on the sidewalk. There was no reason for you to stop and say a word. And as we made our way to the car, we got in. And I said, guys, do you have any idea who that was? And they said, no. I said, that's the guy who runs the whole joint. I said, that's Mr. Pashley. He's the president here at Pinehurst. I said, all that you see, he is responsible for. And I said, this is how you run a company. This is how you run a business. He didn't have to take the time to acknowledge us or to even know that we were there. I said, and look at what all he did and what all he said. And it took no effort. I said, and you see this at Pinehurst from him down, because this is the example that Mr. Pashley sets. And so I wanted to thank you for that from 2 years ago. Wow. And as I mentioned before we started recording this, I wanted to thank you for the stewardship of Pinehurst.
Well, it's what a great story, and thank you for sharing. I remember that moment now that you've brought it back up. And I guess, Charlie, I would just have to say, you know, it's a privilege that we get to have to share in the daily thrill of being at Pinehurst. And if you ever lose sight of that, I guess it's time to move on. But if you don't, if you can't recognize a group of three people like you with the nephew and your son and try to add to their experience, it's like I say, it's just a real privilege to work at a place that means so much to so many. And And while it's steeped in history and tradition, I think there's just so much fun that's being had right now at Pinehurst with the cradle and with that hole in one. And it's just, like I say, it's so much fun for us to be part of it. And we never lose sight of the fact that this is it could be a trip of a lifetime for someone. It might be their one time that they're going to be here, or it could be a monthly trip. But we always want to make sure that everybody's enjoying it. And I just love it here so much. I've been here 23 years. I love it so much, and I want everybody else to love it as much as I do. And so I try when I can to engage with everybody who's here and just make sure they're having a great time.
You being here as long as you have, you'll understand this next statement. I've had this conversation more than once with our mutual friend, Matt Janella from the Golf Channel. I've talked about that Pinehurst, with those of us that love golf and live here in the Carolinas, it is often referred to with the pronouns we and our. You don't get that other places. We take personal possession of Pinehurst. It is a personal source of pride with us. And I think what I have enjoyed most about your stewardship being at Pinehurst is how you've taken that seriously and taken that to the level of, I love this place so much that we can't afford to stand pat. We need to always be looking forward. I know for a fact that you have traveled, and I assume continue to travel, to other comparable golf destinations like Bandon and Streamsong, Cabot. You know the ones I'm talking about. What are specific amenities that when you traveled to those places, before you started to make changes, when you traveled to those places, you said, you know, we can do this, and we should do this, and we can probably do it better at Pinehurst?
Yeah, it is. I love being able to travel and hang out with guys like Matt Janella and others who enjoy golf travel. And so every place we go on a golf trip, I'm always, you know, eyes wide open, trying to pick up on the service level, the amenities, the golf experience, all that stuff. And so I would say what they've done at Bandon is really remarkable, to create something out of nothing. And so we pay a lot of attention to what they do. They actually saw our first version of a putting course that we call Thistle Dew. It was a smaller version than what we have now. Mm-hmm. They saw what we did there, and then they created the Punch Bowl, which is, you know, five times the size.
And it's an amazing sight if you ever get out there to see it.
And they, you know, but they put in little neat tee markers that are drink holders. And so when we redid our Thistle Dew and made it three times the size and put it right by the clubhouse, we adopted those drink holders. So it is, as Matt Janella would say, the golfer wins. You know, as we're all trying to find ways to improve the golf experience, the winner in all of this is the person who gets to travel and take advantage of it all, because, you know, you can't stand pat, you can't sit still and rest on your laurels, because everybody is always in the middle of the next big thing. It's one of the reasons why we brought Gil Hansen to redo Pinehurst number 4. Here you had a great Tom Fazio golf course that a lot of people said was their favorite course at Pinehurst, but it just was not, you know, in keeping with the overall aesthetic here anymore. And so again, not wanting to rest on our laurels and not standing still, we brought him in. And it's really exciting now that number 4 is going to get to host some of the world's best players with the U.S. Amateur returning here in just a few days.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about with you. Tom Pashley is the president at Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I guess the renovation and restoration of number 2 by Corin Crenshaw was probably the catalyst. It began all the big changes at Pinehurst. And it seems like with each one, there was another, you know, we need this box that was checked. I want to sort of go in order by things that I noticed as a frequent traveler to Pinehurst. Let's start with the deuce. For those of us old timers, we remember that there used to be a separate pro shop for number 2. And that was where what now stands, a fantastic gathering place before or after round, complete with a great bar. If there was a common criticism that I used to hear from people who made the pilgrimage to Pinehurst, it was that, you know, there was no place to just kind of hang out after the round. And I know that the changes to number 2 were made with some skepticism and trepidation from some. Surely there were no objections to getting rid of the number 2 pro shop and creating the deuce, were there?
There were some. The retail folks weren't real happy to lose a retail shop, if you will. But it's one of those things, Charlie, now, as people have enjoyed it over the last two or three years, they say, how did you ever not have this? You
know,
what used to be here? This used to be retail? Why would that? You know, it makes so much sense the way it is now. And it's such a neat setting, and the view is perfect. But that one went through a lot of planning. You know, originally, it was just going to be a small little pub, a place to get a post-round drink. And we were going to keep the Donald Ross Grill open for lunch. That was our lunch venue. As we got deeper into the planning, we thought, this is the view, and this is the place to hang out, and this is where people want to be. Let's find ways to and expand it and make the kitchen bigger so that we can serve more meals. But, the Deuce is about 3 years old now, and it really has transformed that the energy level on that side of the building, right behind the 18th green of number 2. When you come up 18 on course 2 now and it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you've got an audience of 40 or 50 people.
Yeah, as if putting on number 2's 18th green wasn't enough. Now you've got to put up with hecklers. We appreciate that.
And it's a neat one of the little traditions we do there, and I don't know if you've had a chance to experience this. If you make a 2... on any hole on course 2, but primarily a par 3. If you make a birdie on a par 3, you make a 2 on number 2, you come to the Deuce, and they give you a special little commemorative coin, much like that poker chip you talked about for the hole-in-one. But
I have two coins in my golf bag that are used as ball markers right now.
Congratulations.
Yeah, Tom, if I were to point to any of the changes and immediately just say, brilliant, it is the addition of the enlarged Thistledew putting course and the Cradle short course. There are lots of putting courses and short courses out there at some of the resorts that we named earlier. But the playability of both of these, here's what I find remarkable. You don't even have to play golf to have fun. If you're there on a trip and you've got She Who Must Be Obeyed who lives in your home with you, who is not all that into golf, but say a father and son are, she can go to the spa, but then she can meet you for lunch and she can have a great time on the putting course or the short course. It is so expertly designed. It has to have just exceeded all expectations you had.
You nailed it. It has exceeded every expectation we could have ever had. And it just makes it stirs your soul. If you're a golfer, if you love the gathering of people to have fun, you just love to sit out there and watch it. And you nailed it. You don't have to be a golfer to go out there and have fun. On Thistledew, everybody misses a putt by 20 feet.
God can't make any of those putts. What are we talking about here?
Right. So it allows you to just laugh it off and have fun, and the scratch player is going to make a terrible putt, and the beginner is going to make an ace.
Yes.
You know, and so everybody gets to laugh, and there's a sense of community out there because you can see everybody else, even on the Cradle, our 9-hole short course that you mentioned. You see every hole, and you have this sense of you're in a special place, having fun, and I like to say, you know, you wouldn't go to the Vineyard and not try the wine. To come to Pinehurst as a non-golfer, you at least need to roll a ball on the putting course or hit one on the Cradle. It used to be, you know, I would take my kids out on the golf course, and you have to shush them, or you have to, you know, tell them where to stand, or, you know, be here, be there. When you're on Thistledew or the Cradle, you know, cartwheels can happen anywhere. You can be barefoot. You can scream. You can holler. And that's what's been so neat about it. It's open to the public, so anybody can come out and enjoy it. And Gil Hance designed the putting course and the short course. He's a world-class architect, and so he nailed it. He absolutely did a phenomenal job. And I think the location is the thing that makes it so special. You are on the front doorstep of the Pinehurst Resort Clubhouse, and it's a special, special place. And to think that where the Cradle sits used to just be 2 par 4s.
Yeah.
Know, two par 4s, and there might have been 8 to 12 people out there at any time. Now you could have 70 people out there playing in eightsomes with music playing on the Cradle with the neat pine cone beverage cart that we have right
there. I am so glad you brought that up. That was the next thing I wanted to say. I spent some time, Tom, with the Disney Imagineers years ago at a conference, the people who dream up the promotions for Disney. And what they would say is they would start with something like, we're going to introduce Spaceship Earth at Epcot. And the next question they would ask was, and then what? Well, let's get some astronauts from the Apollo program. Okay, and then what? And they would continue to have and then what and write these down on a grease board until they ran out of and then what. And then they'd sort of figure out what they wanted to do from there. There was a great idea up there. And I look at the cradle as, okay, let's build a short course. Okay, and then what? Let's make it playable for everyone. Okay, and then what? Well, let's have it with a sort of a loose and fun atmosphere. Let's pipe in some music on the cradle. Okay, and then what? Well, you know what's missing is we need some kind of place where someone can, you know, even though it doesn't even take an hour to play it, you know, let's get some place where we can have some refreshments and sit down. Okay, here's the pine cone. And then what? It's the constant tweaks that make the experience better that I just, every time I go to play the cradle, I sort of go, okay, what am I going to see this time that they've done that have made this even better when I didn't think it could be?
Well, I'd never thought that's a great analogy with the Disney Imagineers and then what? And we'll implement that in some of our strategic planning now. But yeah, it is layered. And I would tell you, you know, the music, for instance, we piped music in on our grand opening day. And it was a kind of a one-time-only experience, and so many people said how much fun that added to the overall experience. We thought, well, maybe we should have music every day. And again, it's this fine line that we find ourselves walking of Pinehurst is a very traditional place and steeped in history. And the statue of Payne Stewart making the winning putt from the 99 Open is only 100 yards away, yet somehow it works. You know, we have to acknowledge that the game is changing and that you've got to introduce new elements to you know, get new participation. So, but something like the pine cone, my gosh, you know, it sits right on top of the third hole of the cradle. There's Adirondack chairs sitting outside of it. So a lot of people will just go to get a drink and watch people play the cradle because it's such a fun experience and listen to the music. So I would tell you, you know, we're not done. You know, I think that we can find ways to continue to use the cradle to grow the game and to introduce new people to it and to find ways to do good. So if you've got any other great ideas for us, keep them coming because I feel we've just scratched the surface with what we can accomplish on the cradle.
Well, I don't know if it's a great idea. I don't know if it's feasible, but I have had it asked of me. Has there been any thought to lighting the cradle for night play?
We get asked that a lot, and we might consider lighting a hole or two. You know, we are here in the beautiful village of Pinehurst, and having something lit up at night isn't necessarily consistent with the laid back lifestyle that we enjoy. So, but it's a question we get asked a lot, and perhaps even the putting course. You know, if we could find a way to light Thistledew so people could just they don't want to leave. You know, they're here having so much fun. And we sit there and wonder, where did these people used to go? Because there really was no reason to stick around. You know, after your round, you would go find something else to do, and now they just continue to stay and enjoy it. And, yeah, lighting it would continue into the evening hours.
He's the president of Pinehurst, and when we return, Tom Pashley continues to take dead aim at what's going on at the Cradle of American Golf, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors, and we continue now with our conversation from late this summer. In fact, right before the U.S. Amateur was held at Pinehurst, with the resort's president, Tom Pashley.
Tom Pashley's the president at Pinehurst. He's our guest taking dead aim. To accommodate the enlarged Thistledew in the cradle, we already mentioned this, some alterations had to be made. I know number 5 was affected. Were you met with pushback upon plan presentation about altering, I guess it was 5-1 or maybe 5-3, and has all that sort of quieted to non-existence now?
Yeah, it was. It it took great creativity from our agronomy team to say, hey, we could find a way to relocate these two par fours. It was the first hole of course five and the first hole of course three. Course three is a Donald Ross golf course. So anytime you're touching a Donald Ross golf course, you have some anxiety. But we really did feel like the benefits would outweigh any sacrifice. And we had very little skepticism from the outset, but now that our members and our guests have had the opportunity to play the Cradle, it was a great trade-off. We did number three, course three became a par 68 as a result of some of these changes. And you know what, in the end, people, you can play it a little faster. Number three is a fun course to play. If you don't want to take four and a half hours, you can get around course three in three and a half hours. So I think there was a little bit of skepticism at first. And like I say, anytime you're touching mm-hmm. one of Donald Ross's courses, you want to be very thoughtful about it. But the benefits have far outweighed any of the sacrifices that were made.
Tom, the latest two moves have been, I know, phenomenally received. You've already brought up one, and we'll get into it with more detail when we talk about the amateur in a few minutes. But, you know, I played and I caddied number four many times prior to Hans's renovation. I was stunned at not only how much I didn't recognize the course at all, and I mean, like I said, I knew the golf course, but how much I loved the renovation and did not miss the old course at all. I mean, I dare say I like it even more than I love what's been done to number two, and I love what was done there.
Careful now, Charlie. If you're going to bring number two,
I know. I know. People, no. Look, people look at me and say, who haven't been there. They say, "Are you high?" And I'm like, "No, I'm totally serious." And maybe it's because I did play it and did caddy on it many times before, that I recognize the artisanship and the craftsmanship and just the genius that Hans was able to capture.
Well, and what you said is exactly what we were hoping for. The debate about which is your favorite, because prior to the redo of number four, it was pretty unanimous. Number two, basically because of all of its history and being a Donald Ross masterpiece with those turtleback greens, number two was, you know, the course that everybody enjoyed. Now, they struggle out there because it's a tough test, but it was their favorite. And now with the new number four, number four has a lot more elevation change than number two does. So that gives you a chance for more visual drama. It has a large lake that a couple holes wrap around. So, you know, for golfers who are looking for a little more visual appeal, you get that out on course four. And with that elevation change, you get all these wonderful vistas. We stood on the sixth green, which is a par three on course four. Gil Hans and I and Bob Farron, our agronomy head, stood there, and we could see parts of 15 different holes from that one spot. And that's vistas that you just don't get on course number two. And so, absolutely, it has transformed that land. A lot of people used to say the original version of course four was their favorite, and then it got changed, and then they loved the Tom Fazio version. And we're really hearing from so many people that this version, the Gil Hans version, we hope is going to, you know, stand the test of time. And a subtle thing that neither of us has mentioned yet, but its visual is much more in keeping with the Pinehurst number two visual, the sandy wire grass, pine straw areas. And previously it was much more manicured, had pot bunkers, and it was a little inconsistent with the Sandhills aesthetic. And so now it feels like a better neighbor and companion to the Pinehurst number two course that it really kind of parallels.
Yeah, I think what I like most is, you know, with Core and Crenshaw, they were able to actually go back and through some great pictures from early on in the mid early to mid 20th century, see Pinehurst number two in its original form and how it was laid out. And so they sort of had a template to go by. With Hans, not, you know, it was never designed that way. With what Hans did to almost pay an homage to number two, yet maintain, or with number four, but to maintain its playability and even enhance it, was just, that's the genius of it to me, was that he was just able to say, okay, I like what they did there. Now, how do we make that fit in here and blend? And it's seamless. It's fantastic.
And one of the best features of it, he didn't want to try to replicate greens complexes like you have on number two, because those are one of a kind. And so what's, you know, he would refer to the greens on number two as with the turtleback shape. They're a little repellent. You know, the ball is moving away from them unless you hit a perfectly struck shot. On number four, the surrounding land funnels the ball a little more into the greens. So the contours on course four funnel the ball into the greens. Once you're on the green, you've got some challenges to get the ball into the hole. But it's a nice contrast. So it's not a mini number two. It's a very different playable golf course, but also a compliment.
Tom, similar to the complaint that I mentioned earlier about the lack of a hang spot that precipitated the deuce, a similar complaint was the lack of a hang spot at night to watch a game, have some beers, get some good pub food, and then boom. You want to talk about a success story. The Pinehurst Brewing Company, just me saying that, I can see you through the other end of the phone. You're smiling right now, aren't you, Tom?
A big smile. Huge smile.
Talk about exceeding expectations. That place, every time I go, I was there for a practice round before the Big Father-Son tournament with the CGA on a Sunday, and my son and I went to lunch. And then after the father-son tournament on that Friday, we went back there for lunch. And in that span of time, 5 days, all the craft beers had been changed out. And we had two or three other menu items we hadn't had before. And they were equally fantastic. And the vibe in that place is just fantastic.
Well, thank you. It's a great vibe. It's a great old building. You know, history. We're all about history here. And we were able to take this 120-year-old brick building that was the original steam plant.
It was the steam plant, right.
Yeah, it produced power for the village of Pinehurst to power the Holly Inn and all the cottages. And then it kind of was decommissioned 35 years ago. It kind of became just a warehouse of stuff that we've always owned it. It's always been part of the Pinehurst company. But then we decided we wanted to do something special with it. Hired a great brewer out of Charlotte, Eric Mitchell, came from Heist Brewery. And so the beer is fantastic, but then we've got a pit boss. We've got our own smokehouse there, so we're smoking our own brisket and pork and sausages. We cook thin pizzas on this gas-fired oven, and so the beer's great, the food's great, the atmosphere's great. There's some really neat outdoor sitting, a great patio. So, you know, it... To your point of there used to not be a real place of any sort of scale. They're neat little pubs in the village and places you can go, but here's a place where you can go and 125 people can be part of a night out and in a historic setting. It has been fantastic. We're going on our one-year anniversary. We're making plans for late September. And to your point, the beers are constantly changing. Our brewer just loves, you know, being creative. I can't wait to get down there right now. We've got a coconut lime sour beer that he's just brought out. There's a great Kolsch. I'm learning so much about the beer business. and it's fun. It really is fun.
Before we get to the U.S. Amateur, one final question about what all you've done at Pinehurst and what's coming up. What's next on the project wish list? Obviously, we've shown through this conversation you're not one that likes to stand pat. What's sort of on the horizon for Pinehurst?
Well, the next thing for us, we have three different hotel properties. So the Carolina Hotel is the flagship, our largest hotel.
The single greatest breakfast anywhere in the civilized world is breakfast before you play golf at the Carolina Hotel.
Yeah, indeed. Yes. And then in the heart of the village is the Holly Inn, a smaller hotel, the original hotel, opened in 1895. And then we have a third hotel, which is our smallest, a 43-room hotel, right above the brewery. It's called the Manor. And so the Manor has been going through a one-year complete renovation process, and it's going to reopen here in about 3 weeks. So the end of the month, so in early September, people begin coming back to the Manor. And it's a really neat hotel. We've taken, you know, the history and the charm of it, but we've given it some modern flair. And so it's positioned for golf groups. We've got neat private rooms, so a group of 4, 8, 12 guys can rent out this private room if they want to have their scoring ceremony there. They want to watch the Final Four. They want to watch the Masters. So we've got two or three different private spaces for people to rent. But it's a modern hotel experience inside a 1920 structure, but it feels like Pinehurst. And so the Manor is going to be the next big thing that we want people to come and experience. And then we just shift into our championship calendar, and which we'll talk about. But the Manor is the next big thing.
Tom Patchley is the president of Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. The relationship with Pinehurst and the United States Golf Association is one that I think has no equal since 99, just off the top of my head here. We've hosted three Opens, a Women's Open. We're about to host the U.S. Amateur. I'm sure I'm missing two or three more. Is that something you take pride in? By that, I mean as the quote-unquote cradle of American golf. You almost feel it's the duty of Pinehurst to be at the forefront of hosting national championships?
Yeah, and indeed, you know, we've got a great championship tradition with our own championship, the North and South Amateur.
Yeah,
so we've started that in 1901. The women started in 1903. So championships have been being played at Pinehurst, you know, for well over a century. But to bring the world's best golfers to this area and have them play, you know, Donald Ross's masterpiece that he built in 1907, and it's been challenging, you know, the world's best players every decade or so ever since then is really special. It used to be for us that, you know, each generation, you know, had a champion at Pinehurst that they could identify with. So you go back to the 99 Open and you had Payne Stewart, and then Michael Campbell won in 2005. In 14, we had Martin Keimer and Michelle Wee. The U.S. Amateur in 08 was won by Danny Lee, who's now on the PGA Tour. So it's really neat to just cycle through, you know, a different generation of the world's best players once a decade or so. And so I go back and look at the last U.S. Amateur that we had, Charlie. We had in 2008, Ricky Fowler was in that field. Patrick Reed was in the field. Johnny Vegas, Billy Horschel, Chesson Hadley, Wesley Bryan. So when the Amateur is played here in just a few days, we're going to be looking at the next, you know, legendary golfers who are going to be playing on national television. And so we get a chance to walk behind them without any ropes, you know, to walk the fairways and watch them play. And it's really special.
In 2014, you already brought this up, you hosted the men's and women's opens back to back. Looking back on that experiment, how did it go? And do you think we're likely to ever see someone attempt that again?
It's funny you mentioned experiment. It really was a risk, if you will, on the USGA's part. They're the ones. We should gladly said yes when they brought the idea to us, and they viewed it as a great opportunity to celebrate, you know, championship golf at the highest level and to be able to watch the world's greatest women play right after the world's greatest men played and see the different types of styles of shots that they hit in and the scores that they shoot. There were a lot of things that could have happened. You know, there were concerns about where would crosswalks be for spectators, and would the women be hitting out of divots left over from the men? Would the greens survive 2 weeks of championship conditions? Big challenge. It was what if you have a playoff? Back then, the USGA was still
doing it. Was 18-hole playoff.
An 18-hole playoff, so the women wouldn't be able to start on time. And all those question marks, it was a grand slam of a success. And the men finished on Sunday. The golf course was in phenomenal condition, so the greens were as healthy for the second week as they were for the first week. You ended up with Michelle Wee winning the second week, her first major. And so what turned out is what could have, you know, had a lot of challenges turned into a grand slam home run. And will it ever be done again? I don't know. They felt like Pinehurst was a unique venue to do it, mm-hmm. because we don't have manicured rough. You don't have to grow rough up to 3 inches. And the club head speed of the women isn't as high as the men. And so you wouldn't have a chance to mow the rough down. So I don't know that it will ever happen again, but if they'd like to give it another try, we'd be more than happy to host it here.
Tom Patchley, the president of Pinehurst, our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the particular aspects of this U.S. Amateur that I find very interesting is that the 36-hole medal play portion of the championship will be contested on number 4, with the match play then moving to number 2. I don't know how unique it is for the entire championship to be contested over two different courses, but I don't think it happens very often, if ever. Was this something that the USGA had to be sold on, or was it their idea?
They like it was a mutual. We collaborate with them, and we've got a great relationship, great partnership with the USGA. So when the plan was made to restore or to redesign the fourth golf course, Pinehurst number four, in the back of our minds, we were hopeful that they might like it enough to move the stroke play qualifying onto it. As we got further and further along, and as they saw the golf course and knew that it would be a championship-worthy test, we began talking about the 36-hole finals. So at the 36-hole, you're down to two players. You start with 312. You have a cut, 64, make it to match play. On the last day, the final two competitors play 36 holes, and we thought it would be really special if the morning round could be on course four and the afternoon round on course two. It had never been done before. But again, they first and foremost, the golf course has to be championship caliber, and they saw what they saw in number four they liked. And they also liked the wrinkle that it might put in a player's mind. If you know that you play number two really well, but you struggled on course four, there's just a little more mental baggage that you have to deal with, which is all golfers need. You just need a little one screw loose to begin the whole thing to unravel. So they liked the fact that it is presenting a new challenge to the players. And again, we love things that have never been done before, like the back-to-back opens, and to contest the 36-hole final match on two different golf courses, never been done before. We're really excited about. So it's going to be really special. It'll be on national television on Sunday. So we can't wait for things to happen next week and to see how it all unfolds.
Then there's people like me that pray as hard from the tips on number six on number four as I do from the tips on number 17 on number two. They're both par threes. They both require help from the Almighty that I do not have. People don't realize, or maybe they do, on Pinehurst proper, where you have courses one through five, you have the Cradle, you have Thistledew. Where is the infrastructure this time going to go with this tournament? Are we going to see the massive tents that we normally do with USGA championships, or is it a smaller infrastructure situation with the amateur?
Yeah, well, it is a smaller infrastructure. While the field is larger, you got 312 players versus 156. You've got a larger field, a lot more to see, but it doesn't come with all the hospitality venues, and the number of volunteers required is much smaller. So what most people, a lot of people say the U.S. Amateur is their favorite USGA championship because it is a much more intimate championship. And so I mentioned earlier that you have the opportunity to walk the fairways with the players. You stay a respectful distance away, but you'll hear, conversations between caddy and player about yardages and wind direction. And so it is, for people who love championship golf, this is one of the more unique opportunities to walk the fairways and not have, not have a 20-minute shuttle ride from the remote parking lot to be able to get a lot closer to the action and to be part of it. So, yeah, it's a national championship, don't get me wrong, but it doesn't have all of the scale that comes along with something like the U.S. Open.
Will there still be tourist play at other resort sites during the amateur week, or is the whole resort kind of shut down and focused on the amateur?
There will still be play being had on courses 6, 7, and 8, and 9. I think even courses 3 and 5, which start on the other side of Highway 5, mm-hmm. they'll remain open. So, but at the main core, anything that's going to be right around course number 2 or course number 4, those will be closed.
Get you out of here on this. Tom Patchley's the president of Pinehurst, our guest taking Dead Aim. In terms of hosting USGA events going forward, and even at this point, do you approach them, or do they approach you, or is there just a constant dialogue of let's look at the calendar and see what we can make happen?
Yeah, it is a constant dialogue at this point. Having hosted three U.S. Opens, and they've done numerous women's opens down the road at Pine Needles, they love this area. They love the support that they get from the state of North Carolina, both from a corporate standpoint and from a volunteer standpoint, from a governmental standpoint. The state of North Carolina embraces them when they come here, so they want to continue coming back. The U.S. Open returns in 2024, so it's nice to have another U.S. Open championship on the books already. And it is just kind of a constant dialogue about let's continue to to look at our calendars and see how things evolve. I know they're coming back for the Women's Open in 2021, I believe, or 22. So, believe it or not, you know, their U.S. Open office is in the village of Pinehurst. So the people who run the day-to-day operations of the U.S. Open Championship reside in the village of Pinehurst and travel. So it's a great relationship, and you know, it's not a question of if, but when it will return.
I just have such a tremendous amount of respect for that man, the president of Pinehurst. That's Tom Pashley from our conversation this summer, right before the U.S. Amateur. And up next, author Kevin Robbins, his book, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year That Changed Golf Forever, takes dead aim at the summer of 1999. In particular, it was the best of times and the worst of times. Presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Kevin Robbins is a professor at the University of Texas. As a Baylor graduate, I forgive him of this sin, as he's written two magnificent golf biographies in recent years. One on legendary coach Harvey Pinnick, and the latest just out last month, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year That Changed Golf Forever. And just a few weeks ago, Kevin and I had the chance to talk. Kevin, I know you've been working on this book for at least 2 years, because I remember us talking about you working on this book for at least 2 years. When did the idea come to you, and why? Was it, were you looking down the line at the 20-year anniversary of Payne's death, or what was the impetus for you to write this book?
Well, that wasn't really the impetus. It was kind of a nice coincidence, I guess, that we could finish it up in time for the anniversary when Payne was top of mind again. And so I wasn't really looking hard for another book idea, Charlie, but I was in front of my computer. It was a Saturday night in November of 2016, I think, and I just accidentally came across the final National Transportation Safety Board report of the flight and of October 25th, 1999, the one carrying Payne Stewart and five other people, including two pilots. And, you know, as government reports are, it was very detailed. There was not a story there, but there sure was a story to be told from this document, I thought. And the document had been released in its final form in 2005. So it came after the initial journalism about the death of Payne Stewart. It came out after Payne's wife, Tracy, had written the authorized biography. So I wondered if there were new ground to cover. There was lots. And also, I'm from Kansas City. I grew up in Missouri. Payne Stewart was someone I kept an eye on, and being from my home state. And so that's really how it started. And it started as a book about the flight of October 25, 1999. I should be transparent here. My agent quickly determined that wasn't a good book topic. It was a good magazine story, maybe, but not a book topic. So I just started looking deeper, and I looked backward, and I thought about that season, and it was really such a good season in golf. The major championships were historic, each in its own way. And so that's how it began, and here we are.
The book is entitled The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, and that title takes on many different meanings when you read the book. It was his last year on tour, the last year of his career. It was the last moments of his life, that flight. There was the Ryder Cup concession to Colin Montgomery, sort of the last stand of golf congeniality in that. And then there was the last stand of his particular style of golf. And you go into detail about that, him and the Hal Suttons and the Azingers. This was 1999 as we were, you know, sort of segueing from the wound ball to the solid core ball, and the guys who played by feel, Corey Pavin's in that group too, as opposed to the guys who began to overpower golf courses, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, etc. When did the title come to you? And it, when it did, was it after you had already considered all of these different things, or did it just sort of happen to fit that narrative?
It came rather late, actually. I think I was probably midway through the story, and it was untitled. I was thinking about a season narrative, a story of a season. And it's not so much that Payne was staging a stand, really. In other words, I don't see him as an aggressor. I see him almost as a defendant. And he was resisting this wave of he and his peers of that generation. And I would define that as players born before 1960. He was defending the game against this wave that was powerful and inevitable and unrestrainable. And it was personified by a 23-year-old Tiger Woods, and behind him, with him, 29-year-old Phil Mickelson and 19-year-old Sergio Garcia. These are all feel players too. I want to be clear about that. They have their own sense of feel. But my point in making this part of Payne's story is that Payne Stewart and Sutton and O'Meara and Tom Lehman, Ben Crenshaw, Corey Pavin, as you mentioned, they learned golf with hard equipment to play: steel shafts, forged iron heads, persimmon woods, wound balls. The next generation, the younger guys, they learned with the equipment that made golf an easier game to play, and that makes possible the golf that we see now on our televisions every weekend, when Brooks Koepka hits a 3-wood 350 yards and Dustin Johnson plays par fives with wedges. So that's my point. I think there are both kinds of field players, but the field player in Payne Stewart and his generation, they had to learn a different kind of feel to move the ball around accurately with the equipment they learned with.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. As you look back on Payne Stewart's life, he was a much more complex individual than I remembered. And as I was reading your book, I thought to myself, you know, may we all benefit from the gift of history as Payne Stewart has. We all remember the guy winning the U.S. Open, kicking his fist and his foot in the air, and then immediately embracing Phil Mickelson and telling him, you know, none of this matters. You're going to be a father, and that's what matters. We remember the concession to Colin Montgomery. We remember him sort of segueing into the position of golf's statesman of what's right and wrong in the game. We forget, you know, this is a guy who was capable of immature and often boorish behavior, even in the process of winning major championships, in addition to being a guy who was capable of donating his entire paycheck for winning a tournament to a children's hospital. Is it fair? I guess that may not be the word, but when you're looking back on a life, should we concentrate on where he ended up more than where he came from? Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, and yes, I think you do. I think that's the way you judge all people, is how they were in the end. We're all evolving all the time. We're all moving in one direction, sometimes imperceptibly, but you know, we're either getting better or getting worse. And we're either improving or we're not. And Payne was, demonstrably. He showed people in 1999 through his actions and his words, but mainly through his actions, that he had grown up. So, yeah, look, Payne as a young man, he ran hot. He didn't know how to manage his emotions, which is something that most elite athletes learn to do, not all, but most. And that's how they achieve greatness. And Payne achieved greatness despite that. He still was an emotional man, I believe, in 1999. But he had learned to control and manage and mitigate the emotions that had gotten him into trouble as a young man. And so, but back to your point, yeah, I think we judge somebody by who they were in the end. We have to consider their entire body of work, their entire lives. And that also is, to my mind, what makes Payne more admirable in 99, is where he had been.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. When I was talking with some friends last weekend after a golf round about your book and about the conversation we would be having, this phrase, this term came up, and please don't think I'm intending it to have the same worldwide impact, but this was, for a lot of us, especially golf fans, this was a sports JFK moment. By that I mean everyone who was alive in 63 knows where they were when they heard the news that the president had been assassinated. For my generation, there are two. There was the Challenger explosion in 84. There was, of course, 9/11. I remember exactly where I was for both things. And as we were discussing this in a sports world, all of us remembered where we were or what we were doing that fall morning in 1999 when we heard about Payne Stewart's aircraft. Do you think that's a fair comparison to make?
Well, I wouldn't compare it in scale or scope to 9/11. Or
oh, no, no, no. That's what I'm saying. Don't take it the wrong way. But just in terms of people remembering where they were when they heard the news.
Yes, that's true. Everybody I've ever talked with about this book, from the people I interviewed to friends, you know, who don't, students of mine, whose parents have talked about it. Yes, they do. And I do wonder why that is. I think the first reason is it was so unusual, and it was so mysterious. And I remember I was a reporter in St. Louis at the Post-Dispatch. We were gathered around a TV in the South County Bureau watching this thing unfold. And it went on for so long, Charlie. It was like 3 hours of televised uncertainty. And there was a plane, a Learjet 35, carrying a famous athlete. No response from inside the cockpit. And no one knew how it would end. Was this plane going to fly forever? Was it going to crash in Des Moines? It seemed like one of those days where anything was possible. And just the intrigue of it all, and the building sense of doom. This clearly was not going to end well. And no one at that time, in the moment, knew if anybody was alive on the plane. It turns out they were not. They had perished pretty early in the flight from a lack of oxygen. And by the time they hit the Florida-Alabama line, they were dead. But nobody knew that at the time. And so, yes, we remember that with great clarity because it was jolting.
The book opens with and I read it twice because it was so stunning. Most of the time, I skip over prologues of books. I just say, whatever that is, I don't care. I'm moving to chapter one. Do not skip the prologue of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart. It is a riveting account of that flight and of what, since none of us will ever really know what happened, it is as riveting an account of what probably happened as you will ever read. As I was reading it, I was wondering, who all were you able to talk to? Did you speak to the fighter pilots that were dispatched? Who did you talk to, air traffic controllers who were on duty at the time? Or did you just get that strictly from the National Transportation Safety Bureau report?
All of it came from the report.
Wow.
I just coughed. There was no need to talk to those people who had this very incidental and temporary involvement in that day. Plumbing their memories 20 years later probably wasn't going to produce anything beyond what was in. And this is how detailed that report was. Entire transcript of communications to the plane, from the plane, all air traffic control communication to outbound and inbound airline pilots who were nearby in the airspace, all radio transmissions between the military pilots and their commanders on the ground. That kind of in-the-moment, authentic primary source conversation really, really made that, I think, that section just terribly dramatic. It was kind of hard to pull back on some. I mean, there was more detail that I thought bordered on the gratuitous, but it was really hard to know where that line was.
Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim. We mentioned the fact that early in his career and really even when he started winning major championships, Payne could be quite a pistol at times and didn't make the best decisions from a behavior standpoint. There was a moment in his life, and I got to thinking about this as I was reading your book, that in a way mirrors Tiger Woods. Follow me on this. For better or for worse, Earl Woods was sort of Tiger Woods' true north. He was his moral compass, not in his own actions, but in his words. He was a do as I say, not as I do kind of guy. And you can point to the unraveling of Tiger's personal life almost to the day that Earl Woods passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Bill Stewart was the guiding force in Payne Stewart's life, his true north. And he passed away before Payne realized the great success of his professional career. And I just wonder, as I was reading your book, I was wondering if he would have lived, do you think that there would have been someone to pull Payne back and say, boy, what are you doing? Stop this.
That's a really, really good question. So I never knew Payne Stewart, and I never knew Bill Stewart. Now, I did visit with Payne's sisters for quite a long time on a couple of occasions, including a personal visit to Springfield, Missouri. And we got in the car and went all over town to see the different places where that Payne had been a part of. I think that Bill Stewart probably was more level and perhaps a better role model than Earl Woods. I try to be really careful in speculating. It's not what I'm.
No, that's probably knowing what we know. That's probably a safe speculation.
Yeah. And but you know, Bill Stewart was a big presence too, and a big personality. He was a salesman. He's the one who suggested to Payne that he adopt some kind of look in terms of his wardrobe in order to be better remembered, to have a style, you know, have a brand. But I do. I guess I would get the sense that Bill Stewart was a more sensible, level-headed, self-aware person who might have pulled his son aside and said a few words. That's really hard to say. It's a fascinating question, though.
Kevin, Tracy Stewart wrote a book. I was talking with someone the other day. You know, it's weird how it's been 20 years. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of us, these people are frozen in time.
Yep.
Aaron Stewart's a grown man who's about to become a tournament director for an LPGA event. And when I was told that, my first reaction was, what do you mean? He's 10. You know, to me, he'll always be that little boy who was there at the service. Tracy wrote a book. Did you have any contact with the family? Did you get the blessing from the family? Has there been any contact with Chelsea, Aaron, or Tracy on this book?
Yes. I did get Tracy's blessing to proceed. I thought that was important. I figured probably rightly that the people closest to Payne Stewart would be reluctant to talk with me if Tracy were unaware of the book or didn't approve of the project in the beginning. With that blessing, Tracy told me that through a letter that she didn't want to do any more interviews. I was fine with that because I wrote this book about what was happening in 99, and anything that really happened in the future, I didn't include. So there's no one looking back and reflecting on anything that happened in 99 or what Payne meant to the world of golf or anything like that. It's a very in-the-moment kind of story. And for that reason also, I didn't need to talk to Tracy or to Chelsea and Aaron. They were 10 and 12 at the time. Their memories of that day, while I'm sure they remember some things, and those would be very painful to recount, their presence in the story didn't require me to do an interview with them, if that makes sense.
No, well, fair enough.
I wanted to talk with people who were present and part of it in 99. And most of the book, as you know, takes place on the golf course or between tournaments or something like that. October 25th, 99 takes up some pages in the book, as do the following 4 days. And the book's over on that Sunday after Tiger Woods wins the tour championship. That's the end of the story. So the bulk of the interviews I did were with people like players, his caddy, Mike Hicks, his coach, Chuck Cook, his friends back in Dallas, who were present and had a part in Payne's life in 1999. So Tracy and I did speak. She did read the manuscript before copy editing. She corrected some errors, which I'm grateful for that. And her overall, I feel like I can paraphrase her overall impression of the book, that she thought that I used too many negative media portrayals of Payne. And that's fair. You know, like I think to myself, if this story were about my spouse, I probably would be disappointed too. And as the writer of this book, I probably would have been in more peril and more trouble if Tracy Stewart had loved the story, because then I wouldn't be beholden to the truth. I'd be doing another authorized biography.
Get you out of here on this. Kevin Robbins is the author of The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, our guest taking Dead Aim, a person who is, to me, a prominent, if it's possible to be a prominent person in the background, he is. And he's mentioned several times in the book. He was a big presence at the Ryder Cup. And I'm speaking of Hal Sutton. And because of the proximity of their names alphabetically, Stewart and Sutton, they many times were lockered right next to each other, week in, week out on the PGA Tour. And as such, there was a relationship between those two guys. The last time we spoke, you had just written a brilliant piece on Hal Sutton, I believe for Golf Digest. And we spoke at that time. I'm sure you had more than one conversation with Hal Sutton about Payne Stewart. Or maybe you didn't. It struck me that Hal Sutton's the kind of guy who, once he had spoken on the subject, he had spoken on it. We weren't going to talk about it anymore. And he's sort of like the last John Wayne left in this town. And he got up and rode off. Did Hal have anything to say, or did he sort of look at you and say, Kevin, I love you, but everything I've said is on the record somewhere else?
No, we did speak. Hal Sutton is a very eloquent storyteller. And in one of the interviews that we did for this book, he started remembering that Saturday night at the Ryder Cup. And that is a story that has been told from a lot of different points of view over the years. It was the team meeting after Ben Crenshaw wagged his finger at the press conference and said something about fate. The American team was down 10-6, looked insurmountable for a single Sunday. But they needed something. They needed something to hold on to. And so Saturday night, they went around the room, each player, and talked about why that moment was important to them. They couldn't talk about the golf. The golf seemed so beside the point. And Hal told me this story about breaking down walls. And he described how on the PGA Tour, because it's an individual sport, players don't really reveal much in a soul way to their peers, because there's this, it really is quite irrational, but there's this idea that if I tell you who I really am, you're somehow going to use that against me on the golf course. If I tell you my secrets, you're going to reveal them on the golf course. It's a strange, strange thing, but I get it. And that night, those walls came down. And my sense of the story is that, yeah, Hal and Payne knew each other because of the proximity of their lockers, but not until that Saturday night did they really know each other. And they stayed up late. They were the last two guys standing. And they decided, well, they were going to do this together and that. They were going to go fishing, and Hal was going to teach Payne how to ride a horse. And when they became Ryder Cup captains, the other would be the vice captain. They made plans. They had dreams. And a month later, Payne got on the plane.
Again, for your gift-buying season for that golfer on your list, I can't recommend the book highly enough, The Last Stand of Payne Stewart, The Year That Changed Golf Forever. That is author Kevin Robbins. I hope you also enjoyed revisiting our conversation from late this summer, right before the U.S. Amateur, in fact, with the president of Pinehurst, Tom Pashley. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show and wonder what all we've covered today, hey, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BePod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now. Links to articles on the latest goings-on in and around the game. Weather-wise, what? You may be dodging rain on Saturday, Sunday, looking pretty good, and the temperature's not too cold if you're looking to let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And hey, if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.